Welcome to Power of the Tribe podcast. I'm your host, John Connors. I'm also the founder of Connors Martial Arts here in Norwood, Mass. We teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, mixed martial arts, Muay Thai, kickboxing. And I'm here, as always, with my co-host, Dan Robin. How you doing, Dan?
Good. How you doing, John?
Awesome. I bet you're about a 7 today.
Yeah, I'm feeling pretty good. I'm going to say 6.
We have a guest today.
Yeah. So, you know, I can't just talk about my new toilet and the...
I love all that.
You can talk about your new toilet. I don't mind.
It might come up. I'm not making any promises.
So I got to introduce our guest, and I don't even know where to begin. He's a blue belt in jiu-jitsu, I think. Is that right?
That's correct.
His name is Lance Reinsterna.
Perfect.
Unbelievable. I was listening to your podcast, and I'm like, I want to pronounce his name properly. You know what I mean? It's not the easiest one. And he just says Lance. He doesn't say his last name on the podcast.
I think in the beginning when we started doing the podcast, I wanted to have some element of mystery to me. But then that has to just go away at some point. You got to get on Twitter and you got to start doing the social thing. And eventually people find out who you are.
They figure it out.
Yeah.
Very cool.
You didn't just want to be known as Lance, like...
Like Madonna?
Well, yeah.
No, Prince. I would love that. Yeah. But.
So Lance has, how many podcasts now are you doing?
We have 3 podcasts. We have Missing More Murray. They're all true crime genre. We have Missing More Murray, which focuses on one particular case that happened in New Hampshire on February 9th, 2004, a missing young woman named Maura Murray. We have Crawl Space, which is more inclusive of a bunch of true crime moments in history. And we talk to criminal psychologists, we talk to journalists, we talk to other podcasters, and we dig into like 3 or 4 cases on a more like immersive level. And we have Empty Frames, which season 1 was about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist in Boston in 1990. And season 2, we're just finishing up now, and it was about significant moments in art history and art crime.
Very cool.
So that keeps us busy.
So that art crime is the...
That's the theme of that.
That's the theme of Empty Frames.
Cool.
And I'm going to make it my personal goal to bring your day from a 6 to maybe an 8.
That's almost impossible.
That's almost impossible. If you listen to this podcast, you realize that Dan is a steady 7. Sometimes he gets down to a 6.
But that's good, is what
6.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
You got to give him the lowdown on your rating system.
I'm just saying it's 1 to 10.
Okay.
And everyone acts like if you say 7, they're like, oh, what's wrong? And I'm like, that's above average. What do you mean?
Yeah, that's 6 more than being miserable.
Yeah, exactly. Like if you say 4, a little down because you have a cold.
Yeah.
People are like, oh, what, do you have cancer? Or, you know, and I'm like, no, I said 4. So that's the idea. 7's good. Bring it to an 8, though. It'll have to be a pretty good podcast.
All right. I'm gonna do my best.
All right.
And Lance, you also did some camera work for us.
Yeah.
On our documentary that we're making. So immediately, one of the most overused podcast words came up. You're a polymath. I hate that word, but I hear it on a lot of different podcasts, polymath.
Polymath.
Yeah.
I don't even know what that means.
It means you do a lot of stuff.
Okay, that's what I thought it meant. Involving math.
I don't think math has to be involved, but yeah.
But yeah, we were shooting for the documentary, and it was really fun to do the cage matches and your training session, which was awesome.
Yeah, we're down there tonight, back down at Plymouth. Yeah.
Yeah, a bunch of guys from the gym fighting.
Tonight. 2 guys tonight fighting. John Ciampa and Will Alfano. Yeah. Should be a great event. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
That's a great venue.
Yeah. Really cool place to watch fights.
I want to ask about, so if you're just starting a third podcast, like it must take a ton of time. I would think just doing one. I think you started right with Maura Murray.
See, what
we
do is we go out and have drinks after this podcast. If we added 2 more podcasts, we'd be raving alcohol.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I don't know how you handle
your
all that alcohol.
Your liver would just be shriveling up.
Yeah. You started with...
Missing Maura Murray.
Maura Murray, right?
Yep.
And then I could see how you thought, I want to get into some more... like more cases.
Yeah.
So you start another podcast.
Crawl Space,
right?
Yep.
And then what happened? You were just like, I have more free time and more interests? And go.
It wasn't so much the free time. It was definitely the interest level. So we started Maura Murray and we didn't realize how it would take off. It developed a pretty big following pretty quickly. And we became limited to just talking about Maura's case. But the more people listened to it, the more they started reaching out and saying, have you heard of this case and this case and this case? And my co-host and co-partner in all of this, Tim, he and I spoke about it. And we said, well, we can't really cover another case on Maura's podcast because it felt weird doing that. So we decided to start Crawl Space, which would encompass more crime. And doing that brought people out of the woodwork. One man in particular met with us and said, I'm really interested in the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist. I really like your style, how you let the story take you along. So we follow the narrative of the story and we react as it unfolds. It's almost done in real time as far as getting details from the case and having people reach out to us and say, have you looked at this element or this element or this element? Sometimes we make mistakes along the way, but this gentleman really liked the way we handled it. We didn't just do like a Wikipedia version, is what I'm saying. There's some true crime podcasts that will tell you this, what happened, like the Boston Strangler struck from this year to this year, and here's what I think. And then it's like, well, I can kind of see you're reading the Wikipedia page. So, you know, we try to talk to family members and law enforcement and establish a relationship. So this gentleman said, what's stopping you from doing something on your own about the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum heist? And we said, well, honestly, like, in order to do that, we need the resources to do it, because I would have to quit my job to do that, my full-time job. And he said, okay, here you go. And he funded season one. And nice. we graciously agreed to do that. I quit my job, and then we turned it into a business.
Nice.
Very cool. That is a compelling mystery. So amazing that they managed to steal that much art. That, and so valuable, right?
Yeah, 13 pieces of art. 11 of them were actual paintings and some sketches. And then you had the eagle finial and the it was like a flag finial.
Mm-hmm.
And this Chinese vase called a gu, I think, the GU. And right now, the estimated worth of all of that is at $500 million. But we interviewed this guy from the UK, and he's a former knocker. And a knocker is somebody who will knock on somebody's door and case the house from having a one-on-one experience with a homeowner. He's posing as something, maybe an insurance agent or something. And then he goes back to the actual thieves and he'll say, they have this, 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 and it's in these positions. So he used to do that when he was younger. He since went back to school, got a degree, and now he's a liaison between law enforcement, museums, people who have private collections.
So would he have knowledge about art? And
he's got a ridiculous amount of knowledge about art.
Right. It's not only that.
It wasn't about the money, if that's what you're asking.
Yeah. Also, he wasn't just like a scout that comes up and, you know, knocks on the door.
No, he
says, here's everything. He also has the critical eye to estimate values. And
yes, very much so. So we had him on, and we've established a really good relationship with him. We had him on in season one, and he presented a plan for the return of the art, because the theft itself has become an industry in itself. So the empty frames still hang in the museum. That was part of it. Yeah, that was part of Isabella Stewart Gardner's will thing. Nothing was to be moved.
Oh, I see.
And if anything was stolen or lost or damaged, then the frames were still to hang in the place. And it's pretty fascinating, but people go there to see it. And
what year was the heist again?
1990, St. Patrick's Day. This man, Turbo Paul Hendry, who is this art liaison between criminals and law enforcement and museums, came up with this new recovery plan. And it required people to return the artwork piece by piece instead of all at once and all in excellent condition, because that's impossible. But he's estimated to get really long-winded answer to your question. He's estimated that you could get up to $1 billion worth of stolen art just by the two major pieces, which is Rembrandt's Storm on the Sea of Galilee and the concert by Vermeer. The concert by Vermeer is almost $500 million right now.
Wow.
So these pieces have been reappearing over the last 30 years?
No, not at all.
No.
None of them.
None of them.
I remember a character that was associated with this crime was Miles Connor. Is that right?
Yeah, Miles Connor. We interviewed Jenny Seiler. She wrote a book with Miles called The Art of the Heist. And it's about his life. Mm-hmm. And he's got the craziest life. Like the old school Boston gangster escaped from prison with a bar of soap. That's not a joke. Like, that actually happened. Like, have you seen that Woody Allen movie where he escapes and it's raining and the soap, like, suds up? Like, they got that from Miles Connor.
A fake pistol out of the
soap. Oh, sorry. I forgot to say that. He didn't like, throw soap at people. But he carved himself a gun out of a bar of soap and colored it with shoe polish or something and fooled a guard and ended up escaping from this prison in Maine. But we interviewed Jenny Seiler, who had a good relationship with him, and she was just like, you've never experienced anything like that. He didn't have anything to do with the Gardner heist, though.
No.
Maybe not. There's rumors that he was told by certain people.
He was a Boston guy with known art theft in his background, so he's...
Oh, no, he had art theft in his background. He stole Rembrandt from the
MFA. I meant known, not known.
Oh, sorry, known. He was actually so prolific and known to the Boston police force, he was in jail when the art theft happened. The FBI and the Boston police were so like keen to his like savvy and his ability to escape prisons and make things happen. They called up the warden of the prison and they said, go check on Miles. And he was like, Miles is in a cell. It's, you know, it's nighttime. Right. And they're like, please.
Just shake him.
Make sure he's just not make like sure it's Miles.
Sure it's not a pillow under a blanket.
You know, a paper mache head or something. But yeah. So the warden goes down there and confirms that that is Miles. But that's how powerful and how sort of substantial
notorious he was. Yeah. Now, why do you think these podcasts are so popular? Not yours in particular. I know you're super talented and you guys do a great job.
Thank you.
But just the genre. Why is the genre so popular, do you think?
I think because it creates such a personal experience with a listener. You go for a run, or you're working out, or you're making dinner, or you're doing anything, cleaning your car. You pop those earbuds in, and it's like you have your buddies that are just telling you a story, that are just talking, not at you. They're talking with you. They're telling you.
And you don't know the
things.
Ending of the story. Because it's sort of unfolding, right?
Yeah. Exactly. You don't know the ending, and you're along for the ride, right along with the hosts.
You know, I watched that show, Oak Island Treasure. Do you know that show?
Yeah.
Why are you laughing?
Because I saw the first season, and I wanted to love it. And then I got through the second season, and I'm like, I don't know how much more they can do. Like,
they've dug it up, and they've sifted it through screens. But you know what? They find something, like a button. And it's a running joke, so I watch it all the time, and I'll text my son, holy crap, they just found a penny. You know, they literally find a button and a penny and a piece of pottery, and it keeps the show going. And
it's super popular.
The amount of money they invested in equipment and drilling, it's absurd.
Is one brother still talking about how he's funding the whole thing?
Not so much. Okay. Yeah, that is less of an issue. Yeah, early on, one of the brothers was very successful in business, and he was funding it. So every time they're like, yeah, we got to dig this massive hole, he'd be scratching his head like, because it was coming out of his pocket. And now they've obviously have some unlimited funding. That's not the case.
I'm sure the network is probably providing them with the majority of the funding.
But what's interesting is how little results you need to keep the game going.
Well, finding Bigfoot is still going, right? I mean, how much results are they getting there?
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I haven't been following the show that closely, but I'm pretty sure they're not finding a ton of proof.
Well, Oak Island comes with its own baked-in mystery. I think that's a big part of what keeps it going, is that, what the hell is that?
And it's like a Rorschach test, because they have, you know, the Illuminati, they have Freemasons, they have Vikings involved, they have pirates involved. Like, every kind of mysterious element, anything that has a mystique for the last 500 years, is somehow they find a way to connect it to it, you know. Right. I was watching it the other night. They had a star map. Oh, if we put this astrological formation on top of the island, it shows that it's over here. It's never ending. It's unbelievable.
But I was going to actually ask you about that for your podcast. Like, is that a worry of yours, or was it a worry of yours, where you were going to, like, I'm going to run out the string on this. I'm going to talk to everybody, and I'm going to follow all the clues, and then it's going to end sometime.
In the beginning, it was more of a worry, but now it's not. There was actually a TV show made of it called The Disappearance of Maura Murray, and the Oxygen Network, which is a NBC affiliate, made that show, and it was produced by a company called The Texas Crew, and they're from Austin, Texas. Great group of guys. They approached Tim and myself, and they were looking for podcasts to pitch to television networks. And this case was one of the most fascinating ones that they had ever seen. And for a period of time, we were told, because we were now part of the show and signed on as associate producers, for no money, by the way. I don't want to say associate producers and we're raking in the cash. We literally told, they said no at first, and we were like, oh, we get it. You thought we were asking for money. We just want our names on there as associate producers because you're using a lot of our source material. And then they were like, really? And we said, yeah, it's actually just your editor typing in our names. Like, it really isn't. I'll pay his time to do that. So anyway.
You are a tough negotiator.
I am. I will pay you out of my own pocket. But so we were actually told not to release any new information while they were producing the show. So it was almost like, it was like 9 months of no new information. And we were.
And did you have new information that you were withholding?
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, we found ourselves being like, what should we do for another episode? Mm. Let's do some emails from the listeners.
And sorry, this is a weekly.
It was weekly show at that time. And then we
went
to like.
Weekly for 9 months.
It was weekly for like 4 months, and then we went bi-weekly because of that, because right. we knew we weren't going to get the opportunity to, for more
Dan, information. Can you imagine showing up to do a podcast and having no idea what you're going to talk
I
about?
I can't even imagine.
It's a very foreign concept to you guys, huh? But
yeah, I was actually thinking about that, where you're putting in the time, like talking to law enforcement yeah. and getting contacts, and it's like, I'm not sure we're putting in quite the background research to each of our episodes.
No, we're a little bit more efficient. Yeah.
We were able to start doing new information like the last episode of the show aired. So we're back on track with new information. We could talk about the show. We had the stars of the show, Art Roderick, he's a U.S. Marshal, and Maggie Freeling, she's an investigative journalist. We had them on the show to talk for a little bit, for a few episodes. We developed a relationship with law enforcement right around that time. And
so could I ask something about that? Where
please.
I imagine it's like a snowball that once you're, you know, some people and you have good relationships and you have a successful podcast, then people want to talk to you. At first, like if you contacted law enforcement or people involved with the case, were they like, who are you? Like, I don't want to talk to you. Or were people friendly from the start? You know, did you, I'm just curious about that, how it started or if you had to.
Well, it started really organically for us. As far as a contact with law enforcement, we were contacted by Texas Crew. They organized the TV show, which introduced law enforcement to us, Art Roderick, the former U.S. Marshal. He established a relationship with the New Hampshire State Police, the Attorney General, and the Cold Case Unit, including the great Chuck West of the Cold Case Unit. And it was his relationship that he developed and we developed with him that enabled us to parlay that into a relationship with law enforcement. So it happened really naturally. If we needed something answered, because we didn't want to be wrong, because we have a responsibility, we would ask Art, and Art would say, let me check with Chuck. And then after a while, Chuck would just email us. And the first time I got a call from Chuck, I looked at my phone, I'm like, I'm going to be arrested. It was really weird to get a call from Chuck West. So he sends an email and he said, you know, can you guys hop on a call in like 5 minutes? And Tim and I are like, oh my God, like, what did we do wrong? He's going to tell us to shut everything down. But right. He was super nice. And we established a relationship with him. We met him when we were up in New Hampshire working on something with the case, for the case. And he said to us that times are changing. He said, we have people who listen to your podcast. Mm. Times are changing. We adapt to the times. Back then, we wouldn't have considered doing something like that. So when we first started doing the podcast, if we had reached out, yeah, they would have said no.
So in the beginning, you just you're at your own devices, like public information and so forth.
Yeah.
And what about non-law enforcement? Like when you reached out to the family or friends or something, how was that received?
The whole Moore Murray case is it's a rabbit hole, and it's really convoluted. And there are people in the community that follow Moore's case that are very passionate. And they're very protective of their information, and they're very aggressive. There are a lot of trolls. So the family has been abused by these people, and it took a long time for Tim and I to separate ourselves from the people.
Get their credibility there.
Yeah, and it wasn't until the TV show started, and that gave us the opportunity to meet Maura's sister and Maura's brother, and we've since established a really good relationship with Maura's sister and Maura's brother, and we've actually started a GoFundMe for Maura. It's if you go to GoFundMe, it's and just search Maura Murray, you'll find it. We raise money with Maggie Freeling to fund searches, GPR, ground penetrating radar, cadaver dogs. We've already been up there and we've used some of the donations for cadaver dogs, for example. And we're hoping to take that money and put it into a larger fundraiser where we're going to do something on her birthday called A Mile for Maura. So you run a mile at hopefully the local high school. We're still fixing the locations. And then there's going to be a silent auction. There'll be donations and giveaways at a brewery down the road. And they'll have stories about Maura pictures. And we're hoping to get donations and take the registration fee to put into that GoFundMe, maybe do something like a scholarship program in her name. And like trail cleanup up in the White Mountains because she used to love to hike. So there's so much negativity in that community. Mm. And we see our responsibility there. Instead of contributing to the negativity, we're trying to use that energy and put it into something more positive.
Something productive.
So, can you explain the negativity and maybe I don't know, in that context, the overview of what the Maura Murray case is? Just like, there might be people who have no idea what happened. I mean, it's a missing persons case, but
yeah. So, I mean, the details of the case are Maura went missing on February 9th, 2004. She got into a single car accident on Route 112 in Haverhill, New Hampshire. It's right on the border of, it's really weird. It's like a little vortex of towns. It's Woodsville, Bath, Benton, and Haverhill. It's all sort of all intersecting right there. And she's seen by one neighbor who's driving a bus. He drove a bus for a living. He comes up to her car. He sees her. He says he'll call 911 for her. She says, no, I already called AAA with her cell phone, but there's no cell service there.
Hmm.
There's no cell service today there. You go up there today at that spot and you're not getting cell service. Hmm. The neighbor across the street, she sees the accident. She calls 911. The guy who's driving the bus goes to his house, backs his bus in. He's got a pretty clear sight line to her, but he's like 100 yards away. And he goes in and calls. They both speak to dispatch. Police show up and she's gone.
Hmm.
And she's never been seen from or any credible sighting. There's been no cell phone ping. There's been no use of her credit card. There's been no finding of any article of clothing that could possibly be hers. And she's just gone.
So where does it stand now? What is there one sort of prime hypothesis of what might have happened?
Yeah. I mean, there are some people in the community who will say, I think this happened. And that's sort of an answer to your question is people in the community will have their theory. And God forbid if you challenge their theory, if they say
I would assume the two theories are someone coming and grabbing her, you know, picking her up, or her getting in a car.
Mm-hmm.
Versus walking in the woods, right? Those are the two.
Well, the walking in the two. Yeah, that's exactly it. A lot of people think that she walked into the woods, and a lot of people will say, do you know how many times people have gone missing in the White Mountains and their bodies are found years later? There's a difference. People don't realize that she wasn't directly in the White Mountains. Mm-hmm. She was in the White Mountain region, but she didn't walk up a mountain. The woods there, if you walk a couple hundred yards into the woods, you'll actually come to another house. There's another road there. There were no footprints going into the woods. They did extensive searches in the days after and the weeks after and the months after. People say, what did she get, you know, devoured by a bear? But the last I heard, bears don't eat. I mean, there's got to be something. Bears don't neatly clean up after themselves.
I hike a lot and hike in the White Mountains, and people get devoured by bears and vanish. Like, it's never happens. Like,
the TV show actually interviewed the lead guy from the New Hampshire Fish and Game who heads up searches, and Mora is just one of two people that he's never found.
Wow.
Yeah.
Over what period of time?
Like 10 Lance. Years.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, she's been gone for 15 years. Right. So, I mean, he's talking his whole career, which is probably spanning up to 20, 25 years now.
So 20, 25 years, only two people have gone completely missing.
Yeah. And Moore is one of them. And the cadaver dogs and the search dogs, the scent dogs, they all lost their scent about 100 yards up from her car. And the way it goes down, and I've seen recreations of it, and we've worked with cadaver dogs, the way it goes down is when they lose a scent, they sit down. Not like, oh, it might be gone. They sit down. There's no going. It's like they hit a wall. There's no going.
So that indicates she entered in a vehicle at that time. Yeah.
Indicates that she walked up the road and got in a car, which sucks.
Yeah. Right.
And so that's the prevailing theory. So why is there negativity in the just sort of the accepted what happened? And why is there back and forth and arguments and negativity? And why is it so volatile?
Would we have like an hour? Well, no. What happens? And this is the very crazy psychology of the whole thing. There's this thing called the wound culture.
The wound culture.
Yeah.
That's a phrase that gets used currently?
That's a phrase that is used by two professors in criminal psychology from the UK.
From the UK.
Elizabeth Yardley and...
Dan, have you heard of this term, wound culture?
I haven't heard it.
So I'm interested, please.
Professor Elizabeth Yardley and David Wilson. Yeah, the wound culture, when I describe it, you'll say, oh, okay, I get it. So... In Mora's case, Mora is missing. Her family is out there looking for her. And now we've introduced social media to it, Reddit, Facebook, Twitter. People reach out to the family and they say, I want to help. I'm connected with Mora in some way. Mm. I'm her age, or I dated someone like her, or
I had a dream about it.
Dream about her.
Yeah.
I can help you. And what families will do, I don't know anymore, but what would happen is families would usually ignore those for a little bit until the person is very persistent and convincing and probably well-intended at the start. Mm-hmm. They probably do have the best intentions in mind. And they allow this person to come into the family and help them with the searches and maybe run maybe some social media, some Facebook groups. And at some point, and I don't know when... But they'll develop their own theory. They'll develop their own past. They'll generate where this girl comes from, why she went missing. They'll start losing their way a little bit, and the family will start to see that, and they'll start to see that the person is becoming possessive about the information that they've started to obtain through the community. And then they'll start getting influenced by members of the community. Whether it's bad or good, someone will say, well, your theory doesn't make sense, or your theory is idiotic. And then they're like, well, why are you calling me an idiot? And then it'll just degrade into something that's not even about the case anymore. And then when the family says to the person, okay, we can't have you do this anymore, or they'll just start to sort of ghost them and not reply to their emails, then the person gets very angry. And they say the family had something to do with it. Why else would they be turning away help like this? And that,
why would they not be returning my calls?
But yeah. No one knows the inner workings of the relationship between the person and the family.
Oh, no, yeah.
They'll do is they'll say, you know, isn't it weird to you that the father doesn't return my emails anymore?
Right.
Isn't it weird? And they won't say exactly what they're thinking. They'll give you like point A and point C, and they'll be like, but isn't it weird? And then you come up with point B, which is, well, the father had something to do with it. Oh, the family's hiding something. Or the best is the police conspiracy. That brings out a lot of anger. Police conspiracy. Hmm. Well, the cops had something to do with it. Why would they do that? Why would they log a time at one time when it wasn't that time? Why would they go and talk to the neighbor and tell the neighbor this piece of information? There's so many false facts out there. It's ridiculous. But
I think we were talking about something like this last week, Dan, when people start associating their identity with theories and beliefs and positions on things. And then if you critique the position, they feel like they're being personally attacked, and they hold on to their ideas even stronger.
Yeah.
And get super defensive.
Yeah.
Right. And we've seen every major event now there's this ability of the public, and now everyone can share ideas on social media of finding facts that some are not even correct. Some are correct, but they seem weird, or they sound, you know, like, how is it possible that this happened? You know, and the big ones like jet fuel, how did jet fuel melt the steel beams and the Trade Center? Like, there's always something that people go, how is it possible? How does that happen? Mm-hmm. And they can find it for anything, right? So I assume a case like this, people are finding something in the police logs, or, you know. Side to that, for your position, it sounds like, so you're in a spot to help with that with your podcast, or a spot to really hurt with that.
Oh, yeah.
So it must be a sort of a responsibility of yours before you say a new theory, or right?
Like, and we've made our mistakes along the way. Mm-hmm. We don't really give our theories on what happened. We do present guests that might have their theory based on an investigation that they're doing. There are professional investigators that we've had on, and people who have been a part of the search parties for not just Moore's case, but Breonna Maitland, for example. She went missing like a month later, about 90 miles away from Mora in March of 2004. And we work with investigators on that case. So they'll look at Mora's case as well. And
was it a serial killer?
What are the similarities? What are the differences? And they'll also, it's almost like you have to, well, this is actually the case. You have to come up with the differences. You can't force your narrative, or else that's going to be extremely reckless. You have to dismiss things in order to be left with the one thing that can only be the truth. I mean, it sounds really cliche, because I think Sherlock Holmes said that, like, if when all else is dismissed, you're only left with the truth, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We had a police officer on once, and he said an investigation's like walking through a big mansion, and you want to know what's in every room, and you want to open the doors to every room, but you never want to close those doors. Mm-hmm. You want to see what's in there, and you need to make an assessment of that.
You know, are you ever talking to a guest and feel like uncomfortable, like this person's adding to the volatility or adding to the anger? Like, you know, I might, do you ever feel uncomfortable? Like, I don't know if this is helping what they're saying. You know?
Yeah, it's happened probably 3 times. There was one person that we had on who had a really great theory. It was actually the only episode that we pulled because he's dangerous. He had a really great theory about the group of people looking into Moore's case, and how it was transitioning from an old group to a new group, and we were sort of the bridge between the old and the new. And he called this group the egregores. And the egregores are people who follow, think of like a sports, like fans of the Patriots. Right. They all, it's like group thinking. It's like mob mentality. You have a group of people all assembled for one purpose. So that's what he was calling the egregores. And it was a really great theory. And we had him on because he was blogging about it, and he seemed like a really articulate writer. And then we realized that he just wasn't stable. And that's that upper echelon of trolls.
I think that's a tricky thing when somebody has a certain amount of energy and they have a lot of conviction, they can sound convincing, but they're not always credible. So, yeah, it sounds like a case like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Did you realize he was unstable during your podcast?
I think right after when he's... And now we can really identify it. There is a sort of DNA to an email that you can.
Oh, that's interesting.
You can see and you can go.
Can parse it out and go red flag, red flag.
Within two sentences.
Huh.
Do you
want to share it with us?
Sure. Sure. If you're reading an email and within the first two sentences there's capital letters that shouldn't be there, that's a red flag. Double periods. Yep.
So you don't mean all caps. You mean just like in the middle of a word. There's a
the way Donald Trump tweets. Like he'll put a capital letter on something and he's like, because I feel it's an important word.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah. And sometimes it'll be all caps. I mean, sometimes it'll be really accusatory, but in the beginning, those first emails,
so
you know, when
random
it's
capital letter.
Yep.
Double periods. Anything else?
I think that's those are the two main flags for me. Also, if there is.
And that's been consistent, obviously.
Yeah.
You didn't just that happened more than once.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And then you can, if you're looking at the email on your phone, here's another one.
Uh-huh.
If you're looking at the email on your phone and you have to do more than three or four swipes, you're like, okay.
Right.
I mean,
we could have
a phone call and this would be a lot quicker.
Right.
I'll take that over these like novels of emails. Like if you say, I've got this theory and I think it's got some legs to it, I'll be like, here's our phone number. Give us a call. We'll happily talk to you about it. But yeah, in those first two sentences, you can, if there's like a frantic tone to it, a couple capital letters, the double period thing is really what gets me. That's what sets the red flag off.
See, we routinely have unstable people on our podcast, but there's
every once in a while we detect a stable person. Yeah. And we drop.
You need a frame of reference.
We need to try to detect stable people, but we've got no consequence because we're not solving a real world issue. So.
Yeah, this is all.
But let me tell you a quick story about this one guy that we had to take down the episode on. He immediately. I'm sorry. You had asked, how did we know? Was it during the interview? Was it after? He sent an email that gave us the warning before it happened. Like he gave us the warning, like, this is an actual thing. Here's a picture of my wife. He sent us a picture of his wife and then went on to say, I don't want her picture out there in the social media. So please keep this to ourselves. And all of a sudden it's like, this is what he's going to do. He's going to create a moniker. He's going to put the picture of his wife out. And he's going to come back to us and say, you just doxed my wife. Just saw that happening. And
yeah, that's insane. Here's a picture of my wife. I don't want pictures of my wife out there.
Yeah, because I'm going to blame you guys. And then he said, I'm so loyal. I'm like the mafia. I'm like, okay, that's also weird. And then
like a German Shepherd.
But I can see how you
could have gone with German Shepherd.
Right. But I can see how you're like, it's not blatant at first, right? Like it's sort of creeping up on you.
It's a game. Yeah. It's a game that they play.
But so did he follow through with the doxing of his wife and blame you?
Oh, he did. No. He followed through with being like doxing himself.
Okay.
And then I hated that word, by the way. I had no idea what it was. He was like, don't you dare dox me.
Right.
And I'm like, D-O-X.
That's a red flag right there. We're using that word, right?
So I looked up doxing and I was like, oh, that just means revealing your identity. I'm like, well, have some balls and just say who you are in the first place. The name he went by was ridiculous. I'm not going to give him the
Scarlet Pimpernel or something, right?
Yeah. He wrote a post on his blog about how the police showed up. It was from the police point of view, and it was like he wrote a police report showing up at his home to the dead bodies of his wife and kids and him. And
that's kind of creepy.
So Tim actually went out into his car because he didn't want his kids to hear this. And he went out to his car and called him and was like, dude, if you're thinking about hurting yourself or somebody else, you need to like give me a call. You need to call somebody. But all this guy did, he wrote that so that people would think that there was a lot more going on than what really he's delusional. He creates this. And it's really interesting because he does have a wife and family. And he doesn't, his wife.
Does he have a job?
No.
And it was a real picture of her that he sent?
I think so. I never questioned it, but so
is scary. So when you have these podcasts, it's a lot of fun, I'm sure, and it's interesting for you, but you're going to pull a lot of people out of the woodwork.
Yeah.
All of them.
It's a real problem for the case, right? Like they have to sift through tons and tons of these people.
Yeah.
And then someone has a real helpful clue or hint or something piece of information and you have to sift through all the garbage.
Yeah. People always think their case is the most important case. Mm. There's a campaign to get the FBI involved in Moore's case.
Mm-hmm.
But the FBI is like, well, there's no justification for us to take funding away from something else and resources to put towards this because there's nothing. There's like the cold case unit is handling it and there's nothing. To your point, what's happening with the cold case unit? Like, what would the FBI do that the cold case unit isn't doing, right, sifting through all of that garbage? Because that's what they'd be doing. They'd be playing catch up for all of the everything that comes in. That one thing might be in there, but it's like 1,000 things that don't mean anything. We receive stuff and we've told Chuck West about it. And he's like, welcome to the club. He's like, this happens to us on a weekly basis.
So you have to sift through at this point the information coming into you.
Yeah.
And decide if it's worth even talking about.
Yeah, we've made mistakes too. We had a guy on who was an investigator right during the time. He was a private investigator right after the disappearance. And he was bragging about his police credentials and how he's worked with the government. And he's an accident recreation specialist. He was the accident recreation specialist for Moore's car. And we interviewed him finally. We had been trying to get in touch with him. We finally interviewed him mid-year last year. And he's talking to us and talking to us, and he keeps mentioning this person, Maureen. And he's like, Maureen said that she was in Maureen. We're like, I'm sorry, I'm not familiar who Maureen is. I'm really sorry. We probably should know this. And he said, oh, Maureen Hancock, the psychic. Yeah. Like, okay, I get it. Like, I get that people are into psychics. We have done the psychic thing. We've gone down that road. She's given us some interesting information. I think that at the very least, they're very intuitive people. And they can make you think differently and about something. You can be too in the forest to see the trees, and they can make you see outside of that. But when a guy who has been bragging about 20 plus years on the police force and saying, I need to see something to believe it, referencing a psychic and saying, she's scary. She's scary good. And we're like, really? You're holding your investigation on a famous psychic now? And I posed the question to him. I said, so when you saw Moore's car, when you were doing the analysis, what was your opinion? And he was like, oh, I never saw the car. How have you never seen the car?
Recreating the entire accident without having...
For 10 years, the car sat outside of Troop F in Concord, the state police barracks, not even locked up. It was literally sitting next to the building. We drove up there and found it by accident. We could have got in the car and hotwired it and started it if we didn't have the respect to go inside and say, hey, can we look at the car? And they were like, yeah. Wow. And they brought us out with a state police officer. The primary accident recreation specialist never took the time to see the car. His findings have been out there for years.
So he didn't have time to do it.
Yeah. So that's one of those missteps that we took. I mean, that information had been out there for years. Other information was this A-frame house that's up there. People had always said that cadaver dogs had gone in there and went bonkers in one of the closets. And that's what people had said, that they went bonkers.
Yeah, I heard about that. I read about that.
Yeah. Well, we started working with people who own cadaver dogs and officially licensed them for investigations. Really, really nice people. Awesome dogs. And she was like, no, dogs don't go bonkers when they get a hit. They sit down and they do nothing. It's the opposite of bonkers. So they
they're so annoying when people use charged characteristic language like that. They went bonkers. What's that scientifically mean? Like, if you're doing a scientific search, you should be using scientific terms. You know what I mean? The dog's indicated X or whatever it is.
Right. So. But for years, I'll say 10 years, that information was out there.
It's exciting. So that gets kept and it gets transmitted. It keeps alive because it sounds
interesting.
So how do you get new information after 10 years? Like, you know what I mean? Like you said, things pop up for the podcast and, you know, and how is that happening? You know,
it happens with people who listen. There's the boots on the ground group and they go up to New Hampshire. It's like almost every, like twice a month, maybe once a month now. And they do boots on the ground searches. They go into the woods. They'll talk to people. A lot of family members from people up there will reach out to us. Law enforcement will say things in a really interesting way. We've had people volunteer their services. There's a great GPR company called GB Geotechnics out of New York and out of London. And they volunteered their equipment. They've gone up there with us twice. So we've gone to suspects' homes and done GPR around the property and cadaver dog searches. New owners of homes, like of people, persons, or locations of interest, new owners have gone in and they say, yeah, if you want to do anything, come on up. So the community up there, certain members hate us, certain members love us, so they'll give us information.
So who hates you?
Aside from like the trolls?
Yeah. That's one answer. The trolls hate you?
Oh, the trolls hate us. There's some of the neighbors up there hate the attention.
You expose them as trolls, or you call them trolls, or you call them out, or
I don't know. That's really interesting.
Is that just what trolls do?
That's what trolls do.
People, yeah.
We've been called, like, I can't even tell you, like, it really depends on what you do and how you can set somebody off. We framed this email that we got because it was just hilarious to us. We work on the Breonna Maitland case, and there was an episode where on Crawl Space, there was an episode where we had one of the detectives on. He's been a detective in Massachusetts, like a chief of police. He's like law enforcement his whole life. He's retired. He does this private investigations now, and he works on Breonna's case. So we finally got the chance to interview him. He's an awesome guy, but he's very deliberate with his information, which is a good sign that he's like, I don't know if I can tell you this. He went up to Vermont to look at some information and to interview some people, and he took one of our co-hosts, Chloe. She's a psychotherapist, licensed psychotherapist, and he took her up and she sat in with one of the interviews, and it was with this woman, and he was describing to us on the air what she did, and he said, let's just say she does webcam stuff. And Tim and I were like, oh, what do you mean, like YouTube videos? And, you know, we were trying to make light of the situation, and it was all like, it wasn't done disrespectfully. It was all done. And Lou was even laughing. He's like, no, not YouTube stuff, you know, like adult webcam stuff. And I made a joke saying, do you think you can forward us that link so we can just do for purely research purposes?
Oh, right. Yeah.
Just check out.
It's kind of a standard.
That's
joke,
pretty harmless.
Yeah. And everyone laughed, and then we moved on because, you know what, we were talking about someone who could quite possibly have been chopped up into pieces and fed to pigs. Like, that's right. We're talking about really nasty stuff, and to break it up in the middle with a laugh kind of keeps the listener engaged.
Okay. Yeah.
So we get this email, and this guy's like, I've followed all of your cases, everything you guys have done, but this one comment about getting the website address for a webcam was just too much. I'm
just
done listening. And he's like, you're disgusting. I'm done listening. And we're like, really? So we framed that email, put it up on the wall. We're like, really?
I think that guy's protesting too much. I would not be surprised if he's visited a few webcam sites himself, you know?
That very well could be. But it just goes to show, like, your question, that how do you, like, what does it take?
If your audience gets big enough, you're going to start just getting people going off on a lot of different
comments. But then I'm thinking, you know, you are dealing with serious stuff about real people.
Yeah.
So it must be really hard to have a sense of humor at all. So that
God
must,
forbid.
Does that weigh on you?
Yeah, it really does.
Because here we're always goofing around and making jokes. And when we're talking about this stuff, I'm like, this is a real person that has family, and it's not freaking funny. So, you know what I mean? It must be really.
And Tim and I are goofy people just by nature.
Right.
Like we met each other when we were doing dinner, like Murder Mystery Dinner Theater, which was like the most ridiculous stuff you can do, because like we just had this sort of a reverent sense of humor.
Right.
So to get into the serious stuff, we break it up with.
At least the art heist stuff, it's not anybody getting personally injured for the most part, probably, right?
So. Right.
And then I think every time there's a missing person, there was a murder in Walpole, there was a murder. I had a friend that was, and we'll say involved in a murder, but he was at a, you know, a girlfriend of his friend got murdered. So each time there's a murder and they don't know who did it, it's almost disturbing. They search the neighborhood and there will be characters, like no matter where you are, like in Walpole, a woman got killed in Bird Park and they went, you know, to a nearby house. I think the dogs led them. And there was a guy, I think he had cats in his freezer, and he turned out he had nothing to do with it. But like when you put that net out, there's going to be suspects like in any area. So I'm assuming that happened in the Maura Murray case too, where they put a net out and they're like, this guy's been arrested for this threatening, you know, maybe this guy has a prior for a similar kind of thing or a kidnapping. And I assume that happened with Maura Murray. I don't know.
Absolutely. And we got an email from somebody who lives in the community, and this person is not happy with the attention, and she had sent an email to another member of the community that likes what we're doing. So this other member of the community up there forwarded us her email saying, just so you know, if you're up here, you might want to stay away from this person because here's what she thinks. So they have this like community email group up there. And she had sent this out to the community email group, and that was forwarded to us by someone who likes us in the community. And she essentially said she couldn't take it anymore. How dare these people come up and try to disrupt our quaint little community, our beautiful little community, where we're all good people up here. And I wanted to write back, like, that net that was cast. Like, we casted a net. We're not even investigators. We did just general searches. And then we had people who were listeners forward us information because they knew how to search better. And then we had law enforcement tell us stuff. And I just really wanted to write back, but I didn't. I wanted to be like, really? Your wonderful community? The guy down the street from you? The guy who you could throw a rock and hit his house? That guy who has a 33-page court document about him molesting his daughter and using his brother and uncle to do that as well? Like, that guy? That guy from your wonderful community? Or, you know, how about the guy across the street who has molested both his daughters? Like, you know, that
right,
his ex-wife reaches out,
right,
to us.
When you pull off the cover on this for an investigation of this type, and you're like, there's suspects all over the place because you wouldn't know it. It would look like a quaint community, but when you look for suspects, there's a lot of them.
Yeah.
That is dark, right? Because then there's other people who just happen to never been caught doing anything too, right?
They'll just go through their whole life. Yeah. Like, there are really good people up there. Don't get me wrong. There are great people up there. We know a lot of the good people who email us, and they're like, anytime you're in the neighborhood, this is what my house looks like. Come by. My wife wants to cook you guys dinner.
That's what's dark about it. It's any neighborhood.
Yeah.
I think you get, you know.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's any worse or better, but just the apathy alone sometimes is just as dark. Just the fact that people are like, get off my property. Well, we're looking for this missing young woman. I don't care. That was 15 years ago.
Hmm.
So we can't look. Her dad can't look anymore. On your property. Sorry. Sorry this happened. Sorry for being an inconvenience twice a year to you. Like, it's just the apathy is almost as frustrating as the actual disturbing behavior.
Sure.
I feel like I'm bringing your day down to like a 3 now.
It's gone a little bit down. I mean, but I'm at a 5. So I'm thinking about, if again, a risk to you if you're stirring up this hornet's nest. Like, do you look at, I assume some of the dangerous people in the neighborhood are suspects. Or continue to be suspects. I don't know the status of that.
That's a good assumption.
And then if you are stirring it up, is that a little uncomfortable for you, or could be? Or
It's a little uncomfortable.
Have you ever felt that you were in physical danger?
Yeah. Yeah. It was probably unfounded. Probably had no base in reality. Right. But people have done a successful job making us feel uncomfortable. Hmm. We went up there to go on this hike to this area on the side of a mountain with these coordinates that were sent to one of the journalists who was writing about the case. He's in Ohio, and these people sent the coordinates, or this person sent coordinates to him saying they knew where Maura was and gave him these GPS coordinates. I mean, he'd been to the area before, but I don't think he realized that Boston really isn't that close to the White Mountains.
Oh,
but
right.
He was like, since you're so close, can you go check this out? And we arranged to do it with a guide who was very prolific in that area with hiking, and he knows all the trails. So Tim and I arranged to do it, and then a couple of days beforehand we started getting these weird emails and tweets, and someone tweeting us a picture of a penny saying hashtag Maura Murray, and the penny has Lincoln on it. We're going to Lincoln, New Hampshire. We're staying in Lincoln, and it was the year of Maura's it was 2004, the year of was it 2004? It was the year of her birth. Sorry. It was like 1982.
The penny had a date on it of the year of her birth. Is that what you mean?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And we started getting these emails when we got up there from this person named Miles Wainwright.
Did people know you were going?
No one knew.
Yeah, so that's a little strange.
Yeah. Too. No one knew. So we kept getting these emails that sort of escalated in these veiled threats. And there's a case up there about a gentleman named Tommy Conrad who was shot in his mother's front yard, and it's unsolved, and it happened around the time of Maura's disappearance. And the person referenced that murder and said Tommy Conrad was basically assassinated in his mother's front yard for not keeping his goddamn mouth shut. Hmm. And we were like, is that a threat? And we were in our motel room at the time, not hotel room, a motel room.
Yeah.
And we were like, and Tim was a new dad at the time, and he was like, I'm not doing this. I'm not going on something that could be a trap. So we called that off, and the next morning at like 5 or 5:30, our motel room phone rang. I answered it. It was nope, nothing, and then click. So they hung up, and we met up with the guide about I don't know, 2 or 3 hours later. And he was like, did you call my room this morning to wake me up? And we're like, no. And he goes, someone called my room this morning. Hmm. And he went down to the front desk and they were like, well, maybe your buddies called your room. So he was like, oh yeah, that probably makes sense. Maybe they called my room to make sure I was up. We're like, no, we didn't call your room. As a matter of fact, we got a phone call too that hung up. So we're like, all right, let's get some breakfast and get the hell out of here. So
that's pretty weird.
Yeah, I don't know. I think you started by saying, oh, we were probably just imagining it, or like we weren't really. That sounds pretty,
I mean, I don't,
pretty spooky.
We ended up going to the coordinates a couple years later with the television crew because we felt good about that. And of course, there's nothing there. And that whole moment in our experience with this, that whole moment in the case, just sort of sums up what can happen when you're just being so reckless about information. Somebody had sent these coordinates to a journalist who works on the case, who wrote a book, and he had a blog on it, and some people don't like him, some people do. So they send it to him, and then it was 2 years later. Yeah, it was two years later, while we were in production of the TV show, he got another email saying, 2 years ago, I told you where, look again, she's still there. Same coordinates. So then the TV show was like, we have to go do this. Hmm. They went up there, they had camera equipment. And this was a hike that I hike, and it was a hike that knocked me over. Like, it is a hike for experts.
So it's likely somebody playing some kind of prank or something like this.
Yep. But what they did was they took like with the crew and with us, I think there was maybe 10 people, 9 or 10 people that did this. The crew was carrying heavy equipment.
Yeah, that's hard.
And then it wasn't even off like on the trail. It was off the trail. It was like 75 feet into the woods, and the woods was so dense and thick, and the mosquitoes, and you're walking on fallen brush, so you really weren't even walking on the ground, and like sticking shovels in where the coordinates were. I mean, it's a wonder we didn't hit a bee's nest, like, or a hornet's nest. And I had nightmares of that after, because I never thought of it. And I was in there with a shovel, like one of those little camping shovels, stabbing at the ground. And then that night I was having these like waking nightmares of hitting a bee's nest. And because all of the trees and branches and everything were just like encompassing you, there would be no place to run. Mm. You just sit there and get stung to death.
Yeah. I've doing these bushwhack hikes, and I always think about hornet's nests and be
like, where would you go?
I don't know, just try to start running.
Yeah.
But also you're tired. That's the other thing, people, you're not going to like just go sprint. I guess you'll get an adrenaline shot, but you're on a mountain. It can be hard to just sprint. And where are you going to sprint to?
Where are you going? You're not jumping in any water. Maggie and our, the guy who was guiding us on that trip with the camera crew, they got stung by a hornet on the way down. Yeah. And I think that's what kind of got into my head a little bit. And then later on, once we were off the mountain, which the whole trip was like 13 hours. It was 13 hours of hiking, and some people threw up after because they were dehydrated. Not me, because I'm a badass. But I started thinking about that after, and like the irresponsible, like someone out there sent those coordinates and could have killed people.
Mm. Like they sent them twice too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The camera crew was carrying camera equipment, and the sound guy was sliding down rocks. Hmm. Just like, what are we doing? And someone out there is like, they're typing this in their computer and being like, 2 years ago. And they come up with this rhyme, and I was like, ooh.
Yeah, there's people out there, right?
What did those people do pre-internet? They must have been bored out of their skulls where they couldn't torture people like this.
I don't know. Have you ever heard of the Toynbee tiles?
The what? Yeah.
The Toynbee tiles, I think that's what they did. They would. Yeah. That's really fascinating, the Toynbee tiles.
Yeah, there's a documentary on it, right?
Yep.
Was it Netflix? I think I saw it.
I think it's on Netflix, yeah. Yeah, I forget exactly what they say, but it was these tiles that someone drove around. They had a hole in the bottom of their car.
Each one was a little different, though, right?
But with the general message on it.
It was a hole in the... Like, tiles would just appear in major cities, like on the street. And I saw some, and I actually saw in Manhattan.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, I wasn't even looking for it. And I'm like, oh, wait, that's one of those tiles.
Yeah.
But then in like South America, I think, and major cities, like these tiles really pressed into the road.
So, it would be the tiles, and then they'd put the tar over, and then eventually as cars would drive over it.
And they would expose
it. It would expose
eventually.
It, and it would say, it was something about Stanley Kubrick, Life on Jupiter. It was like this message, and then they had these big manifestos that would come up. So this documentary is awesome. It's about these people who are trying to figure out who did this. And
wow. Pretty well solved it, I think.
It was pretty close.
It looks like he cut a hole in the bottom of his car so you could pull up to like a stoplight and
then he would install them.
Yeah. But so I think that's what people did before the internet. I think that's what trolls did before the internet. He's like, well,
something crazy.
Yeah.
That's like a, almost like a Banksy thing or something, like going to all that effort, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who's the guy that had the Andre the Giant stamps that he put all right. over?
Oh, Shepard Fairey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something similar, right? Yeah. Really weird. Well, I don't know. How do you feel, Dan? You were seven? Where are you now?
I can physically see him smaller now.
What have we learned today?
I'm still at a
that
six
there's
or seven.
A lot of dangerous criminals around us and generally creepy people who aren't actually violent criminals.
I feel bad that we didn't talk about the toilets.
Oh, we covered the toilet.
We covered pretty thorough
toilet
talk. You flushed
that
topic out.
Yeah.
The one last thing is where you see this going, the case going, like, and do you see like a future, you know, do you see it ending at some point? Do you see a breakthrough? Do you not know?
I see a breakthrough. Unfortunately, I think if anything were to be found, it's not going to be very cut and dry. It's not going to be black and white. It's going to be, we found what we think might be her cell phone, or we found what we think might be a body part. And then it's going to just evolve or devolve into how did it get there? Who put it there? Why is it there? Where are the rest of it? I don't think we're ever going to... Maybe I'm wrong. I hope I'm wrong. I hope somebody does it. Maybe
you never know.
Maybe there'll be some ground penetrating radar that goes over a location and there's a disturbance, and then the homeowners allow the person to rip up the concrete and they find her, and then you connect it to whoever poured the concrete at the time. But just finding her is not going to end it, unfortunately.
Well, Lince, thank you so much for coming on. This is fascinating.
I had a lot of fun. I hope I didn't bring it down, but thank you guys for having me on.
I feel like there's more to talk about.
There is,
just out of time.
Been here. Yeah, we're way out of time. I think we're over. So we didn't even get to talk about jujitsu or anything. But
I noticed the cast on your arm. Is that from jujitsu?
That is. Yeah, I got this robot brace.
Yeah.
Two more weeks.
Awesome. So could you give the name of the podcast again so people can listen?
Sure. It's Missing Maura Murray.
Yep.
And Crawl Space and Empty Frames, and you can get them wherever you have access to podcasts. Empty Frames and the archived episodes of Crawl Space are on Stitcher Premium, and the early episodes of Missing Maura Murray. This is kind of cool. The early episodes of Missing Maura Murray are on Stitcher Premium, and Tim and I are delivering in batches of 10 episodes with creator commentary over it, much like a director commentary in a film. Because there's so much information out there, and because we're totally different people now than what we were then. So we listen to the episode, we comment on it, we give ourselves a fair amount of grief, but there's information there that's either wrong, not wrong, or there's developments that have happened since then. So we fill in the listener, say, I know you're listening to this right here, but here's what we know now. So if anybody's following the case and they listen to those early episodes without the commentary, then they have to go through the whole process of 94 episodes to get to where we are now with the commentary. You kind of get it all in one package.
Cool idea.
So that's Stitcher Premium, promo code MMM, get a free month. It's $4.99 after that, and they got a ton of other information on there. I mean, other podcasts.
Very cool.
Should we go back over some of our episodes and be like the toilet seat, like with our commentary? Like, what's the update?
If you want to do something that's therapeutic, that you should do that. It's awesome.
We got to check in. How's Sober January going? Quickly.
Easy.
No easy problem. Pie.
One more week.
So
you're a marvel.
The sweating and the shaking has nothing to do with it?
Yeah, the tremors have stopped. So.
Delirium.
And we're going to do a no cookie February. Is that what we figured out?
No snacks at all.
No snacks February.
Ooh.
I have a lot of respect for you, man.
Yeah.
What constitutes a snack? Like anything with like processed ingredients?
I think it has to be any like chips or cookies or candy or those kind of thing. Like, so I don't know how to write. Like, I heard cutting sugar means cutting bread and cutting, and I'm like, I don't want to look into that, any of that. Mm-hmm. It has to be...
A snack.
Yeah, obviously a snack.
Okay, like a bag of carrots is fine.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Doritos is a snack. Double Stuff's a snack. You know what I mean? Like, obvious snacks.
Quick question about Doritos. If someone were to tell you to go buy a bag of Doritos, what flavor would you get?
I'd get original.
Like the nacho flavor.
I'd get the original flavor,
Way back, I was working a job, and they said, could you give me a bag of Doritos? And I came back with a nacho flavor, and they were like, I want a Cool Ranch. was like, well, how would I know
that? That's crazy.
And they were so baffled. They were like, why wouldn't you give me Cool Ranch? I'm like, well, you asked for Doritos.
I think you got trolled.
early indicating.
So we sided with you. We didn't even know where you were going with it. We said original. So
sometimes I'll just riff.
But you're justified, obviously, because we both thought original Doritos.
Absolutely. Why wouldn't you?
And we're pretty much always right.
Yeah. We've established that, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're pretty much the only people you should consider gurus or heroes. Yeah.
Yes.
And oh, okay.
And so take every bit of advice with a grain of salt, except for the advice you hear from us, even if it contradicts itself.
That's awesome.
I think that covers it, Dan. What do you think?
I think we've established that over the course of several episodes.
All right. This is, Dan, another awesome episode. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
This is brilliant as always. Thank you, Lance.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you for coming in. Folks, please subscribe and share this episode. Check out all of Lance's podcasts, and we will see you next week. Thank you.